Okay, this lecture is going to cover information from chapter 25. And what I'm primarily concerned with is I'm looking at the Ottoman Empire, most specifically Egypt. And what we're going to be looking at is the rise of nationalism throughout the Ottoman Empire throughout the 19th century, and also the rise of European powers becoming invested in the Ottoman Empire. Ultimately, what we'll find by the end of the early part of the 20th century is that the Ottoman Empire will dissolve. It actually will dissolve right at the time of World War I. What I'll be focusing on specifically with my case study of Egypt is I'll be looking at the complex institution of Egypt, basically the ruling entity. The Ottoman Empire, at its peak, stretched from Hungary in the north through Greece, around the Black Sea, south through Syria, and across Egypt, all the way west to the borders of Morocco. But during the empire's last 300 years, it steadily declined in power. The declining empire had difficulties trying to fit into the modern world. However, the Ottomans made attempts to change before they were unable to hold back the European imperialist powers. What was going on in the waning days of the 19th century, in the early days of the 20th century, is that the Europeans were really interested in extending their sphere of influence. They had already carved up Africa, and they were looking elsewhere to see what else they could control. The Muslims had pretty much controlled the most of the perimeter of the Mediterranean. And this Muslim power was really starting to wane. And it's going to be into that vacuum of power, if you will, that the Europeans are going to start to encroach. As you can see, looking at this map, the Ottoman Empire went through many stages of growth and then retraction by looking at all the various shaded colors. World powers, by the end of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, were very attracted to the strategic location of the Ottoman Empire. As you can see by the map, the Ottomans controlled access to the Mediterranean and the Atlantic sea trade. So merchants in landlocked countries that lay beyond the Black Sea had to go through Ottoman lands. Russia, for example, desperately wanted passage for its grain exports across the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean Sea. This desire really influenced Russia's relationship with the Ottoman Empire. Russia really wanted to win Ottoman favor, so they formed alliances with Ottoman enemies, and finally, when the Russians couldn't win Ottoman favor, they formed alliances with the Ottomans' foes and enemies, and finally waged war about the Ottomans. And I'll talk about that in a later slide. Geopolitics is an interest in or taking of land for its strategic location or products. This notion of geopolitics, which once again is an ideology, really played an important role in the fate of the Ottoman Empire. As I said in my last slide, looking at that map of the Ottoman Empire, you could see how it had a really strategic location. And I mentioned how world powers were very interested and attracted to its location. I mentioned primarily how the Russians were very attracted to that landmass. So each generation of Russian czars launched a war on the Ottomans to try to gain land on the Black Sea. And this is really going to cause problems throughout the Ottoman Empire. In 1853, war broke out between the Russians and the Ottomans once again. This war was called the Crimean War, after a peninsula in the Black Sea where most of the war was fought. Britain and France wanted to prevent the Russians from gaining control of additional Ottoman lands, so they entered the war on the side of the Ottoman Empire. The combined forces of the Ottomans, Britain, and France defeated Russia. The Crimean War was the first war in which women, led by Florence Nightingale, established their position as army nurses. It was also the first war to be covered by newspaper correspondents. From the Crimean War, the weaknesses of the Ottoman Empire on the military front were very well were revealed very well. Despite the help of Britain and France, the Ottoman Empire continued to lose land. The Russians came to the aid of Slavic people in the Balkans who rebelled against the Ottomans. So, by the end of the war, the Ottomans had lost control of Romania, Montenegro, Cyprus, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and an area that later became Bulgaria. The Ottomans also lost land in Africa, too. So by the beginning of World War I, the Ottoman Empire was reduced to a small portion of its former size. Observing the slow decline of the Ottoman Empire, some Muslim leaders decided that their countries would either have to adjust to the modern world or be consumed by it. Egypt and Persia both initiated political and social reforms, in part to block European domination of their lands. For the rest of this lecture, I will use Egypt as my case study. Modernization came to Egypt as a result of the interest in the area created by the French Revolution. Egypt's strategic location at the head of the Red Sea appeared valuable to France and Britain. After Napoleon failed to win Egypt, a new leader emerged, Muhammad Ali. And Muhammad Ali was mentioned quite extensively in your textbook. The Ottomans sent him to govern Egypt, but he soon broke away from Ottoman control. And this is what we'll talk about in the remainder of the slides. For the remainder of the slides in this lecture, we're going to be talking about Ali, Muhammad Ali, and his rule of Egypt, and the rise of nationalism. So let me just diverge for a moment and talk about nationalism for the next few slides before I talk any more about Ali. Nationalism is an ideology, and it became one of the most powerful ideals of the 1800s into the 1900s. Arab nationalism developed most vigorously in Egypt. And it developed in Egypt first because Ali had first opened the way to growing European influence and example. Now, we're not really going to see nationalism in Egypt really take a full stand until the early 20th century. But many of Ali's goals for the country inspired this nationalistic ideology. As I said earlier, nationalism was the most powerful ideal or ideology of the 1800s into the 1900s. Its influence stretched throughout Europe, and as we can see with this lecture today, into the Arab world of the Middle East as well. Basically, nationalism shaped countries. Nationalism is an ideology where people believed that those individuals of a single nationality or ancestry should reunite under a single government. So, for Muhammad Ali of Egypt, he placed the country, the nation-state of Egypt, ahead of the Arab world. So, for him, it was more important for his people to place Egypt first and their Arab background second. That's kind of a new feeling, a new sentiment. As nationalists saw it, a number of links bound a people together as a nation. Some, though not all, had to exist before a nation-state would evolve and survive. So the List of characteristics that really bound people together are a belief in a common ethnic ancestry. This belief may or may not really be true in reality. Different dialects of one language would form into one common national language. So the different dialects of that particular region would form into one national language. Nationalists share a way of life, meaning their food, dress, behavior, and ideals will be similar. They share a common past, a common experience, if you will. They have a shared religion by most or all of the people. And they have a certain territory or landmass that belongs to the entire group of people. Lastly, when people foster a sense of nationalism, they will defend that nation's territory and way of life. They will represent the nation to the rest of the world, and they will have the nation state, the country, if you will, embody the people and its ideals. Those are all characteristics that Ali was striving to create in Egypt. Again, he basically paved the way for nationalism to take root in Egypt. As I said in an earlier slide, in 1798, when Napoleon successfully invaded Egypt, the Ottoman Empire had been rocked. When Napoleon was finally forced out of Egypt by British pressure, plus Napoleon's own ambition to gain power at home, an Ottoman military officer by the name of Muhammad Ali took over Egypt as a virtually independent ruler. And after installing him in Egypt, the Ottomans never did fully regain control of this vital province. In office as ruler of Egypt, Muhammad Ali represented one of the first non-Western leaders, and certainly the first in the Middle East, to adopt a self-conscious mission to modernize his society. Unlike Peter the Great, who we learned about in a few weeks ago, who had visited the Western world, Ali never visited the West, but he greatly admired Western achievement and realized that he had to try to match some of that Western achievement. So he began a series of reforms in the military and in the economy. First, he personally directed a shift of Egyptian agriculture to a plantation cash crop, cotton. By producing cotton, this brought Egypt into the international marketplace, but it was at a cost to the peasants. The peasants lost the use of the land they traditionally had farmed. They were now forced to grow cash crops in the place of food crops, and that's going to cause hardship. In addition, Ali will also institute some other reforms in the society. For instance, he'll establish a printing press and sponsored the translation of many Western books on science and technology into Arabic. This is really key. It's providing learning and education for more people. In addition to using Western teachers, he sent a number of Arabs to study abroad. French actually became a second language to educated Egyptians. Though Ali really tried to make some beneficial changes to Egypt, he was unable, as your textbook says, to break through the hold of tradition on a much of Egyptian society and the limitations imposed by Western domination of the world economy. You have to remember, at this moment in time, European imperialism has had its tentacles all over the globe. Remember back to that image in an earlier lecture on imperialism with the octopus. So Ali is really going up against a very terrific foe. Egypt became increasingly dependent for export earnings on the Western market for cotton. So it really had to compete with other producers of cotton, including the southern United States and India. And Egypt's cotton did not always command favorable prices. So that led to its export earnings being frequently insufficient to pay for the machines and military equipment that Muhammad Ali sought to use. So his regime was increasingly forced to go into debt and depend on Western banks. And this really happened repeatedly throughout the Middle East during the 19th and 20th centuries. As your textbook reiterates, governments tried to modernize and adopt new armaments, industrial machinery, and an array of public buildings and urban amenities. However, they were thwarted at every step of the way because they didn't have the money to do what they needed to do, so they borrowed money, and that really hurt their economy. Okay. With Muhammad's death in 1849, Egypt was changed, but Western control was steadily increasing. The lasting effects he was hoping to create really had not taken hold as much as he had wanted. When he died in 1849, he was actually bitterly disappointed in his limited achievements. As your textbook says, his efforts stand more as an early example of an attempt to adapt in response to Western standards than as a successful revitalizing regime. His revitalizing efforts, however, were continued by his grandson, Ismail, and I will talk about that in a little bit more detail. Ismail supported the construction of the Suez Canal. This canal was a man-made waterway that cut through the Isthmus of Suez. It connected the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. It was built mainly with French money and Egyptian labor. The Suez Canal was opened in 1869 with a huge international celebration. However, Ismail's modernization efforts, such as irrigation projects and communication networks, were enormously expensive. He ran into a similar situation as his grandfather. Egypt soon found that it could not pay its European bankers even the interest on its $450 million debt. The British insisted on overseeing financial control of the canal, and in 1882, the British occupied Egypt. British control of the Suez Canal remained an important part of British imperial policy. Basically, the canal, which is pictured on your screen currently, was viewed as the lifeline of the empire because it allowed the British quicker access to its colonies in Asia and Africa. One British imperialist by the name of Joseph Chamberlain presented a speech to Parliament, and in it he supported the continued control of the canal. And this is what he said, quote, "I approve of the continued occupation of Egypt, and for the same reasons I have urged upon this government the necessity for using every legitimate opportunity to extend our influence and control in that great African continent which is now being opened up to civilization and to commerce." End quote. And that quote is an example of a primary document. And what we can see from that quote is that Chamberlain and the British that he worked for were really interested in asserting their influence, and they really didn't care what effect it had on the people it subjugated. The legacy that was left to the Egyptians with the British is quite detailed. The Egyptian government grew weaker and weaker and more indebted. As your textbook suggests, Egypt did do some beneficial things to Egypt. It helped sponsor railroad construction and a massive dam on the Nile. It increased the amount of water available for irrigation and agriculture. It also abolished slavery in Egypt and expanded the school system. But these positive gains could not quell the spirit of nationalism that really started to take over the country of Egypt. As your textbook suggests, Egyptian nationalists resented economic controls that really, in their view, prevented them from becoming a fully industrialized country. They also resented their lack of political rights and the arrogance of many of their British colonial administrators. Basically, these Egyptian nationalists were educated city dwellers, and they were able to really see firsthand the privileged position and luxury of foreigners in their own country. This growing tide of nationalism will really be felt throughout the 20th century in Egypt and in other Middle Eastern and African countries. And it was only in the last couple of years that we've really seen another indication of this desire for autonomy of their own countries. And most recently, we noticed it, not most recently, but in the last few years in Egypt with the overthrow of the ruler of Egypt. So again, this sense of nationalism that's being fostered in the 19th century really has repercussions still being felt here in the 21st century as well. This is the end of the Prezi on nationalism, an ideology that really surfaces in the 19th century into the 20th century that's still being felt today in the 21st century.